cliffcentral.com.
Welcome to the Renegade Reports. I'm Jonathan.
And Romani's present. Witt, how are you?
I'm well, and yourself, Kevin Eck?
I've got very distressing news, actually.
Do you?
I went to my barber today, a true story. And I walked in and I said, Henry, I want to look like a Nazi. And he said, which
as
one?
As you do, you know?
Yes, yeah, I want a Nazi haircut. And then his response was, oh, which one? Hitler or Himmler?
That's very funny. So he's obviously had large requests.
Can you believe it? Alt-right is taking root in this country.
Terrible.
And we have to root them out. And we'll start with my barber. So
we will start with what? Pitchforks and torches?
Well, I'll get the gun, you get the bullets. And we'll drag him out in the streets of Rosebank tomorrow. make a public sacrifice.
Sure. Was he upset about the latest Trump revelations?
I don't know. I don't think he knows who Trump is, to be honest.
Or gives a shit.
He cuts a lot of hair.
Shame.
What's the latest Trump revelation?
No, everyone in America just losing their minds over, you know, Russia investigation. So a bit of that going on.
He fired James Comey.
He fired Comey, and then there's, I don't know, he's been a bit of a moaner lately, actually.
Oh, he's the most persecuted politician ever.
I'm a bit of a victim.
Don't you know that?
Yeah, I it's not a good look on him, actually. But enough about Trump, because we got stuff going on at home.
We do?
Well, we've had in the past couple of weeks, we've had people burning down other people's homes. And
we had people burning other people.
We've had that too. There's some crazy, crazy stuff going on. And obviously, in keeping with our great respect for the hashtag Men Are Trash theme,
right,
we've invited another male onto the podcast.
And don't mention that he's white.
Yes, white males are trash. Would you like to introduce our guest?
Indeed. So our guest this week is Mr. Rian Malan, who is not very well known. He wrote like a book that did quite well a few years back. And now he writes horrible, horrible pieces about what he sees in far-flung towns in the Northwest. So, Mr. Malan, welcome to the show.
Well, very nice of you to have me. And you've forgotten my third epithet. I'm also a Dutchman here, so yeah.
Oh, also. Yeah. Right.
Is that a politically correct term?
No, you'll have to come after me with pitchforks as well.
Sorry about that.
Microaggression.
Only when the revolution comes. You don't have a Nazi haircut, so it's not quite it's not obvious that you...
Offensive.
That you terribly offensive or part of the alt-right. Apparently, we are part of the alt-right. Somehow we created it out of nowhere on this podcast.
It's kind of like someone signing you up to a porn site on the web. Like we didn't know it happened, but we're just part of the alt-right.
I'm sort of old school, so I still read newspapers. But I must say, of all the figures who've appeared in the American horizon in the last several years, Milo was just amazing. I mean, I miss Milo terribly, the highest entertainer. Okay, Trump trumps him. Trump's more entertaining, but I mean, Milo was really...
He was good value.
Brilliant and outrageous.
He was good value. Although he got a bit repetitive towards the end of his, before the explosion of being outed.
But I mean, talk about America. I mean, you lived there for a number of years during the 70s. I mean, you left South Africa, what, in 77, somewhere around there?
I left in 77, yeah.
To not get conscripted into the army, which I approve of, by the way, because I hate military stuff.
Well, that's kind of you. I mean, if you'd met me as I stepped off the plane in London, I would have said that I was a just white man and I couldn't bear too moral to take up arms against apartheid. But, dude, I'm too old to lie anymore. It's like I didn't want to cut my hair.
I think that is a better excuse, actually. In my opinion.
So how long were you out of the country for?
I was in America for about 8 years. I eventually got a green card and almost within a day or two of getting this green card, trouble started. That was like in 1984. Trouble started in Sebokeng and like South Africa caught fire. And it looked as though the war that I was trying to avoid it at last started. Instead of congratulating myself and staying where I was, I got on a plane and came back again. And here I am.
What for? Was it just to document what was going on, really?
Dude, it's like, I hate to sound like a liberal, but I mean, my impression of this country is that, you know, it is always, you live, in the midst of these titanic dramas in which everyone, even the lowest of us, we all feel as though we're actors in something much larger than us. And America was just so boring in comparison with South Africa. So I came back, and no, I wouldn't say I regret it, but here I am.
Can I just reflect on that statement? You say you don't want to sound like a liberal, but when you came back in the 80s, you would have been very much regarded as quite on the left, as very much a liberal. In the past week or so, and we'll get to your latest writings, but in the past week or so, you've very much been pretty much called right wing.
Yeah.
And all the sort of epithets that go with that insult, which often don't really apply, but nevertheless, they get thrown out there. What do you think's happened to the liberal left, so to speak, that someone like yourself, who essentially refused to serve the apartheid government, purposely removed themselves from that and then came back to try and get involved in ending that regime, it is 25 years later seen as right-wing?
Ah, dude.
And an extremist.
A right-wing extremist. Well, if you insist. Listen, I definitely was a sort of dog socialist when I was at Wits in the early 70s. I used to attend all the demonstrations, and I used to finish everyone else's lines about socialism and how I'd had the logic of gravity in South Africa. And then I went to America, and the first election when I was there was Jimmy Carter versus Reagan. And I was out there like sort of trying to motivate my drug addicted and apathetic friends to get to the polls to vote against the beast Reagan so that we could. And when Carter lost, I wrote him a letter saying, "Don't worry about these people saying nasty things about you. We in South Africa, we will remember you." And I got a handwritten reply, which I thought was quite cool. But shortly after that, I joined this organization called the Second Thoughts Forum, which is run by a guy called David Horowitz. It was like an Alcoholics Anonymous for disillusioned communists. And
But David Horowitz is a phenomenal figure. I don't know him, but I read his books, and he was on Rubin Report a few months back. Phenomenal figure.
Yeah, I mean, for me, the reason he had credibility is that he'd had second thoughts himself. He was an enfant terrible of the American Communist Party. By the time he was 21 or 22, he'd written this whole stack of books with impossible titles like Marx and Shakespeare and Empire and Revolution. And then he woke up one day and he realized it was all nonsense, and then he started trying to help brain-damaged young South Africans like me to overcome our, to take the cataract off our eyes and try and see socialism clearly. South Africa, when I came back to South Africa, I didn't know really what was going on. I got off the plane and my nostrils were assailed by the reek of, shall we call it Stalinism or maybe Fidelism. It's just that the UDF of that time, is the American press had been telling me that these guys were liberals like me, or like an army of sort of hymn singing Martin Luther King types who just wanted to move to the front of the bus. But up close, their color was red and their slogan was "Socialism is freedom." If that answers your question, so.
That kind of gets lost in the history somewhere.
Oh, dude, I don't want to sit here and say that I struggled against apartheid. It's ridiculous. I did a bit. I was questioned by the security police. I had my mail intercepted. I used to write things that the establishment didn't like, but it's cheap coin. I'm just another. I'm one of them, a white South African.
Yeah. Although not framed in the way that is as a group framed these days. The collectivist white South African is the white privileged South African who has only benefited from that system, and in theory did nothing to fight it. So I do think it's worth something.
Dude, I think that's kind of nice of you. I was read one of my rare forays onto YouTube the other day, and I found some really glamorous black American girl. First of all, she's doing her fingernails, and then she started recommending books to read. And here are both of my books, and she says, "I've read this guy. He's like really great." So I suppose that's an endorsement that counts for something.
Who's this American YouTuber?
I have absolutely no idea. She seemed to be some sort of star of some sort or other, because she was she was in her crib, and she was doing her fingernails, and she was chatting to her camera, and then she held these two books up and said nice things about me. So I've got at least one black friend left in the world.
So My Traitor's Heart was quite successful as a book. You want to tell us a bit about that? You know, listeners who might not have read it and don't know what it's about and the sort of dialogue that might have created?
After the... I guess the thing that I'm most proud about My Traitor's Heart is that for like much of the last two decades, like foreigners, especially diplomats and businessmen, people coming to South Africa keep telling me that this is on the essential reading list for everyone who comes to South Africa, because they said, not me, that it was a really rarely honest account by a white person of what it was like to live here. You know, at the time that I wrote that book, the view of South Africa was Manichaean. It was white vice versus, you know, white evil versus black good. And if you begged to differ, it was very difficult. You know, you'd got people with pitchforks would come after you, because South Africa was the one hard rock in a global swamp of relativistic equivocation, the one place where the lines are drawn. My South Africa, even at that stage, was complicated. I think the only people who really understood the book were white members of the South African Communist Party, who understood exactly that this is a right-wing book written in left-wing language, and that I was there for a wolf in sheep's clothing. Anyway, the book caused a lot of controversy and was taught in universities and translated into various languages. And hey, it got republished the year before last as a vintage modern classic. So I'm up there in a very small way in the sort of small print at the very bottom of like a series of really great authors, beginning with Joseph Conrad. So,
yeah, I mean, and I think you'll continue to be part of that upper strata, because the local authors here have a lot of bluster, but no one writes classics anymore, thankfully so. But I mean, in the conclusion of that book, of course your mind has changed a bit. It's been, what is it, 27 years since it came out?
No, dude,
you have changed.
It's long. I finished that book. I finished the book in my mind in October 1986. It's a bad time in South Africa. We were supposed to have a race war, and I had to decide what side I was on. And that's basically what that book is about. It's an autobiography masquerading as a... It's a political argument masquerading as a book. And at that stage, I often find myself then, as I do now, in the cold and deep darkness of ideological outer space, like contemplating like war and horror and genocide, and so putting my gun to somebody's head and pulling the trigger. And I just decided, I reasoned my way to think that at the end of the day, almost all political questions, if ultimately resolved, they acquire a religious aspect. So I ended my book on the note of this woman who'd been really disillusioned by her experiences in Africa, her expedition of consciousness into an Africa that most whites listening to this have never even imagined. And she had a pretty bad experience, but she sort of, I mean, the concluding idea is that, you know, all love is all you have to hold against the darkness. And if you give in to the darkness, you become... I'm going to sound really religious. Hitler will live forever because of what he did. Afrikaners did a lot of bad things along the way, and it seemed to me that I couldn't really ultimately, at the end of the day, scar myself, Metilla, if you're going to say that. But I mean, this is the... I was looking at the end of that book the other day, and I think this is exactly the situation that black South Africans are in now. The shoes on the other foot, you know, the balance of power has changed radically. Now we are a small minority. And I think that a lot of black people listening to that, especially those who support certain extremist movements, I just want to warn you about something, dude. You pushed one way by the commands of your blood and genes, and you're going to be pulled the other way by the dissenting voices of your heart. Listen to the latter, because if you don't, you'll regret it one day. Your name will be Kak, like Hutus, for the rest of your life, and maybe unto your children and children, your sins will be visited upon them.
I agree with you in that regard. I mean, do you think there is a... How do I explain? Do you think that there's an air of culpability now in that some black South Africans are becoming, well, they've always been aware, but they're aware that they are part of the reason why this country's going to the dogs, in a way, due to their voting patterns, due to what they wanted from the powers that be, things like that. I mean, do you think there's a reckoning happening within the mind of the average black South African?
Did you see astonishing amounts of it in the in columnists like Malala, politicians like Matthews Poser, in the crawl spaces and the comments below, sort of controversial articles. I think that an awful lot of Black South Africans would share my dread apprehensions about what's going to happen next in this country. I hope their numbers grow, because I think our situation is quite serious.
What do you think will happen?
Well, it's got to look like this. I think that the modern era in South Africa started, and for me it started in Easter 2010 when Julius Malema went to visit Zimbabwe, and he appeared in the Sunday Times that Sunday morning sort of singing the praises of Mugabe and saying, Mugabe shows us the way, this is the path that we must follow. It was completely out of line with ANC policy at that stage, and so I waited for him to be repudiated or drawn into line or some statement to be issued. I waited 3 or 4 days, and then I wrote an opinion piece for The Telegraph saying that the game had changed completely, and I ended it with the Latin phrase, te moratori salutant, which in retrospect was like sort of a bit heated because it means those you're about to die salute you. But I think looking, as soon as Julius took up the extreme position, started playing the race card with the enormous skill that he does, the enormous skill and vigor, he started a chain reaction, because extremism begets extremism. It created a situation where it was very difficult for other forces in Black politics. In order for them to stay abreast of Malema, they had to move towards extremes themselves. And I think we saw the culmination of that process, say, in the State of the Nation address this year, where Zuma committed himself to a whole series of radical new ideas, including radical economic transformation, whatever that means, a lot of rhetoric about building socialism, pushing the revolution to its conclusion. And finally, expropriation without compensation of land. So, I mean, this is a dangerous situation for us to be in.
I mean, I agree it's dangerous, but do you actually believe them? Do you actually believe what the ANC says? Because I don't think they believe themselves, what they say. And you may call me naive on this, I understand if you do so.
They're selling a product, right?
Oh, they've got a revolutionary brand that they're trying to... I mean, I'd say the tempting thing is to say that all this, and especially in the case of the president, is a smokescreen to create a barrier behind which he can hide. It's like sort of more nefarious motives, which have quite a lot to do with maintaining power and enriching himself and his family, and of course the Guptas. But on the other hand, it's like if he feels the only way that he can hold on to power is by sidestepping Julius or outflanking Julius to the left and promising even more loot and easy gains and easy solutions to the masses in South Africa. That's, you set in motion processes that maybe he wouldn't be able to, even if he did, that's not his end, maybe that he wouldn't be able to correct.
Yeah. I'm interested just in terms of a comment you made, in terms of going down the sort of hole, and what gets ascribed to you and your name and your legacy. And I suppose apartheid in some way will always be ascribed to the Afrikaner nationalism and the Afrikaner in many respects. Do you think that South Africa's heading basically in a very similar direction, and you've mentioned a lot of points in history. Are we going towards a similar kind of rule where I'm not suggesting a reverse apartheid or anything as simple as that. I'm just suggesting something as horrible as that time.
When I look into the future in South Africa, dude, I struggle to understand how we as South Africans, as a collective, is how little we've learned from what happened in Zimbabwe over the last 20 years, shall we say. All these people who attack me and say that I'm a racist because I say we're going towards Zimbabwe. Dude, just because I'm paranoid, it doesn't mean that isn't necessarily true. And I think that basically the consequences of a certain kind of extremism and of using it to shield the interests of the parasitic elite of the ruling party those set the precedent for what we're looking into. And as we know, it's like, who welcomes this in this country? You know, half of Zimbabwe now lives in Johannesburg. The country is in a state of ruin. 7.9% inflation per annum in like 2007 or 2008, and 95% unemployment. If we had to believe these things, so if this is, it's like a sort of without. If we don't take cognizance of this, don't kind of read the writing on the wall, we're going to die of stupidity.
Yeah, I can't disagree with that. I think, you know, it occurs to me that in the early 2000s, there were people who were saying, and I'm not sure if you were one of them, but there were people who were saying that we were heading towards a Zimbabwe situation in South Africa. And at the time, many people were very optimistic about the country. And there were some good reasons to be optimistic. And anyone who basically said this was basically fobbed off being paranoid, as you say, or just reactionary or not realistic or just stuck in the past and all these kinds of things. And it seems as if the further we get away from those times, the more we do head towards that Zimbabwe-like situation. And I just wonder when we will start to actually have those very real conversations, because you've mentioned it, we've mentioned it on this show in the past, exactly as you said, the ANC, as a result of people like Julius Malema, has moved to try keep up and has moved so far to the left that we look to be repeating those mistakes. And I'm not sure how we potentially avoid that.
Dude, I don't care if people call me a racist. I love this fucking country. My heart is as pure as the driven snow. I assure you, I'll be admitted to heaven. I'm 62 years old, and the towering fact of my life, the thing that killed everything else, is the rise of China. What happened with the rise of China is Deng Xiaoping, after the death of Mao, looked around and said, this is pathetic. You know, 50 to 70 million people have died of communism and the Great Leap Forward and starvation in the last, since our party came to power. There's absolute misery in this country, and the tiger economies of Asia are taking off, and sooner or later our people are going to recognize. So let's fix this, dudes, comrades. And then he comes with a small idea that he's just going to free the collective farmers from the yoke of collectivism and allow them to farm in their own interest. So if you work harder than me and you grow more tomatoes, you can sell them, you can keep the profits, i.e. you accept the meritocracy, and that the result is going to be unequal. And this is like tossing a match into a tank of gasoline. The whole country goes woof. And 40 years later, the whole global power balance has changed, and China's got the world's largest economy. And this entity that we hate in South Africa, white monopoly capital and the imperialist West, has been bloodied. And it's been bloodied by the adoption of a form of free enterprise. You can't argue with that. This is the way, this is the engine that drove China. I cannot believe that South Africa is not a country where everyone doesn't understand that, where we're still having these antediluvian 19th century fights about the merits of socialism, what happens if you nationalize the banks, and it just...
Because we have these answers. We know what happens when you do that.
You take an egg and you drop it, it breaks. It doesn't bounce. It's not going to bounce. It's not going to bounce again. Look at Venezuela. Look at what's happened to the 2015-year experiment with Chavism, which is like a close cousin of Fidelism. And so for the disaster, there's no food. There's no medicine in the hospital. People are desperately unhappy. Zimbabwe is a screw-up. Why are we even talking about emulating these countries? I'm not saying this to defend white interests. I don't care if you kill me. I'm old. My life is already over. That is the truth. It is the overriding truth of my time. We should. So
why are we defending these things?
Why is that happening?
Well, I think it's at least in part the pernicious legacy of the South African Communist Party, or if you will, of the sort of Marxism that the Soviet Marxist Leninists it propounded. Where first of all, this one thing is that because your struggle was righteous, it was okay to use violence to pursue the ends. And secondly, the blind faith in the socialist utopia and millennia. I think it's an idea that over time, is like, and in various forms of dilution, has really captured the imagination of the chattering classes in South Africa. When I look at some of the syllabi that are taught, for example, at Wits University, the university I once attended, and the utterances and the academic writing of some of the people who teach there, I think it's Well, this is Ken Owens' line, not mine. You know, it's basically like a Marxist-Leninist sausage factory. I don't think people are ever exposed to ideas from the outside that might obliterate this cocoon that they live in. So I just think that, you know, and the other thing for white people, South Africa is like socialism. It's like a solvent. It's a way of dissolving your whiteness, and you can pretend that you're on the side of Africans. So it's very attractive to a certain kind of white left winger for that reason. Makes you feel as though you belong and that you're on side with the comrades, and this gives you a mission in your life. I'd wonder about that. But the other thing is it promises these easy answers. All we have to do is nationalize the banks and the land, and then the heavens are going to open and manna will descend on us and we will be blessed. Comrades, we won't. We will not be blessed.
No, we won't. And the problem is, I mean, I blame whites for this. Liberal whites are like the worst people in South Africa at the moment, because the problem is they see black people as a pet project. They are deeply, deeply patronizing, because as soon as a black person goes off the plantation, metaphorically, as soon as a black person is a capitalist, or as soon as a black person has ulterior ideas that are not socialistically inclined, they are a traitor. And other white people call them like a race traitor or an Uncle Tom or a house nigger or whatever the case might be. It confounds me that black people accept this from these fucking white liberals who, you know, Malcolm X said 50 years ago, beware the white liberal.
And
they still take it.
Well, all I can say is amen. It seems there's a certain kind of snobbish, well-educated, usually well-off white left liberal academic. They need blacks to be victims. Without victims, in whose name that they can speak, they can't demonstrate their virtue or signal their virtue, and they're, you know, the mission in life is going to be lost. Listen, give me a drink or two, and I start sort of imagining I get into conversation with like sort of white leftists, and the next thing I'm just imagining I've got a baseball bat and the head's going splat as I swing at them. And this is a very ugly thing to say, but I mean, it's been argued. There's a certain, I think it's a, ideologically speaking, the ideological climate in South Africa is to a considerable creation of white academics.
Yes.
And I really don't know. And to some extent, it's like I think that they've misled black people, but they've certainly created a lot of acolytes in their own image, who isn't. You can count on one hand the prominent black non-socialists in South Africa.
Yes.
We know their names. Often because they're so vilified.
Indeed.
I mean, to start with Herman Mashaba, it's like if you're not black and you're not a victim, if you're proud, you say, F off the begging bowl. Don't patronize me.
Yeah, I can make my own way in life.
I will force you to respect me. Then suddenly you're a house nigger and a coconut and a... It's ridiculous.
And it's not just a local phenomenon. I mean, it happens all over. It happens in the USA as well. I mean, you could count the five, you know, top black conservatives. You know, it's Thomas Sowell, Walter E. Williams, you know, people like that. And they never win Nobel Peace Prizes, despite Thomas Sowell writing the most important books of the 20th century. They never get the Presidential Medal. They never get anything.
Clarence Thomas is another one.
Yeah. Mm. They never get recognition at all. But you got fucking DeRay, what's his name, Mackeson, who starts Black Lives Matter with his fucking little vest. He tweets about Taco Bell all the time because he's sponsored by them. And he gets an audience with fucking Barack Obama the very next day. That's a fucking outrage.
I would say the Thomas Sowell, shit. Could this be, for the first 50 years of my life, is that man's name was never mentioned in South Africa? He didn't exist other than in my imagination by 10 other people that I knew. But I mean, if your readers never heard him, he has a money back guarantee. Get his seminal book is The Economics and Politics of Race. It blew my juvenile Fitz left head off when I read it. I couldn't. Yeah, anyway, an extremely powerful, well-argued book. Great man.
Yeah, a fantastic man. He was like you. He was a Marxist in his youth. He believed everything you believed. He grew up in Harlem, in New York City. And you know, he has a revelation, and now he is the most, to me, the most well-respected, just a genius. He writes about economics, culture, politics, religion, anything you want in the world. And he's a phenomenal man, and no one knows him. His books aren't prescribed at universities. No one quotes him in – okay, we quote him on this podcast, but we're the only ones by far. And he, and this is a black person who came from poverty, who has conquered everything he set out to conquer. He's written the most important book of the 20th century. And what does he get from socialists? Nothing. They don't even know he exists.
Or if they know he exists, he gets quite a lot of hatred and demeaned, really, because, and it's not about fighting his ideas. It's just about fighting, taking on the man, because unfortunately for them, he represents a
he's off
destruction
the,
yeah. of their reality.
Yeah, he's off
which is not in touch with reality at all.
He's off the plantation. He's off the slave plantation, and therefore exactly. He's an enemy.
A free black man with a free mind. You know, people listen to this might think we're all insane or radical, but I really think that that's fate presents young black Americans with a very difficult choice. Is that, have you read The End of Racism by D'Souza?
No, not yet.
Well, just to be black in America, just like sort of one anecdote. When rap became very big and acts like, I'm probably not allowed to say this, so I'll say N.W.A.
Niggas with attitude. Oh, please say whatever you want.
Anyway, so you know that the content of rap music, especially the early hardcore stuff, was like, you know, slap bitch, suck here, shoot policemen, etc.
Yeah.
Total disrespect for all forms of authority, from schoolmasters to pastors, and a lot of glorification of violence. So you find black parents all across America like really being worried about this and trying to starting this nationwide campaign to shut it down. And one of the things that they were saying is like, who are the people pumping this music into this vile and music into our children's imagination? They said it's all white people. It's like, and then it's being the process is endorsed by New York Times critics and, like, you know, the most important white writers in America, who think that, hey, these guys, they get glorified as rebels and they're not taking shit and they, you know, they dress sharp and so forth. And they said this is something that white America is actually doing to us, and they're making us pay for it. What amount of attention, like, sort of, you know. This was like some years ago in America, but it's the sort of thing where you start, as soon as you say things like that, then you're deemed to be uncool and you're slave mentality, a self-hating Negro. And it's simply not true. And I long for the day, in the African context, the African Renaissance begins on the day that history throws up a black conservative leader who's just going to say one thing: I am not a victim. I am not here to be a victim. I don't want your charity. I don't want your pity. I want your respect. Now watch me. I'm going to blow the whistle, and like Kami in Rwanda, blow the whistle, and at 6 o'clock every Saturday morning, everyone's going to get out in the streets and go and clean them. I will follow that man. Pillars of smoke and fire in the sky. That way to a better future for everyone who lives in South Africa. And it's not going to be socialist. I can tell you now.
but isn't Mashaba, he's been in power for a short amount of time, but don't you think like that alone I would never have predicted, to have a conservative mayor in Johannesburg?
Well, I guess this goes to show that I better check my microaggressions and racist generalizations at the door, because South Africa is complicated. Whites like me have been here for 3.5 centuries, and in that time a lot of Africa has rubbed off on us, and I think vice versa. I don't think the battle for South Africa is by any means over at this stage, but it's on. The battle is on, and it's time now for people to stand up and declare themselves.
No, indeed. I mean, that's what we're trying to do with this podcast, in a very small way, but...
Yeah. So the battle is on. Let's use that as a segue to Coligny. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
The people who live there say Coligny.
Okay, so Coligny. So, as I'm sure everyone is aware, there's this incident that takes place with this young boy or man. I'm not sure how to term it.
He's 16.
He's 16. A 16-year-old boy who is found allegedly stealing flowers. And is loaded onto the back of a bucky and being transported to the police station. And at some point in that process, he dies. and I hope I'm not misrepresenting anything there. I'm not trying to be as unbiased as possible. And obviously, it's two white farmers, and it's a black child. And as we know in South Africa, this is just the perfect opportunity for a fire, really, a metaphorical and what turned out to be literal fire of racial division. And there are many people in the media, in politics, who enjoy stoking that fire. So you go there, and I get the sense that your approach to journalism is very much like what I understand Al Pacino's approach to acting is, which is that he basically
method acting.
He immerses himself in the entire process. Is that fair to say?
Yeah.
So tell us a bit about before you wrote the article, because if you haven't read the articles, pause the podcast now and go Google it and read it. But before you write the article, while you're there and in the subsequent days after that, tell us a bit about what happened and your thinking.
Listen, I went to Colony basically because it seemed to offer a chance to examine the link between extremist rhetoric, all whites are thieves. I admire Hitler because he killed white people. I love Hitler for that. And so between that sort of rhetoric, of which you've heard a lot in the last 3 years, and what actually happened in Colony, because at least from the outside, in the media, it was generally portrayed as a spontaneous outburst of black rage, unpremeditated, apparently leaderless, nobody taking responsibility. And then triggered once again by the assumption that the charge made against these two white guys, largely since they were white and Afrikaans, and since the victim was at least initially deemed to be a 12-year-old black child, there's a single witness who says he saw them beating this child to death. They've got another side of the story, and the police have, I'm afraid, the investigation has proceeded very slowly. They haven't found any other witnesses. The post-mortem hasn't been completed, and if the post-mortem had been turned in, I mean, this is surely going to settle the issue. You know, if I was to beat you to death with my fists and feet, your body would bear very different scars from those that would carry if you'd fallen off the back of a bucky. But anyway, so there were all these unknowns. I arrived in Colina, and it was probably naive of me to assume that I could get black people to talk about that. And everyone wanted to talk about racism in the town and how they felt that they were victims of racism and that the boys didn't like them and they were forced to speak Afrikaans. All these alibis for what had happened, which is basically be charitable as a principled demonstration that almost immediately generated into indiscriminate looting, went on for 24 hours before police restored order, and then resumed again after the funeral of the boy, which was addressed by important ANC leaders who I believed poured flames in the fire. They certainly didn't sort of call for calm and let's wait until the facts in there. The provincial premier rocked up and said, I'm tired of white supremacy, I'm tired of white superiority, I'm calling all whites to show them that they are visitors in this country. And other speakers, prejudged the issue entirely that this was a racist murder. I'm sorry, man, I'm getting off the...
No. Perfectly fine.
At the time I was in the town, there was a perpetual crowd outside the magistrate's court where this bail hearing was underway, and all the journalists were hanging around there in the main road, which had been looted and trashed. And I just did, what journalists do, you know. One of the things I did that nobody else had bothered to do is, as soon as I arrived in this town, I asked, what is that burned-out building? And somebody told me, that's the old Indian group area where Indians were consigned in the 1960s or 70s to apartheid, and here was this gutted house. So I thought, well, that's interesting. The drama, as it's been portrayed in the newspapers, the question of black versus white, just black retaliation for white abominable behavior, whatever the case may be. I thought the best people to talk about this would be Asians, they who occupy a sort of position between the two racial extremes. So that led me, one step led to another. I found myself at the mosque and here, unheralded by any media, the real victims of the rioting that went on, which is 53 mostly Bangladeshis, Somalis, and Ethiopians. who lost everything. These guys used to, had spaza shops and tuck shops in the in Coligny's township, and anyway, they fled for their lives with nothing but what they the clothes that they stood up in. And so I started getting, it's like suppressed truths acquire awesome power. I didn't write that piece to prove what had happened. I simply had the temerity to underline certain aspects of the official story that hadn't been like told properly, i.e. the experience of the foreign traders, the experience of one or two Indians, and just sort of question South Africa is the sort of country where one of the headlines in I think Times Live was, you know, that Coligny is trapped in apartheid time warp. And, you know, that might well be true, but
Is that your sense of it, though? Because we get told black and white, whites are rich, black are poor. In Coligny, is that the sense of it, or is everyone just trying to sort of make a living?
No, Coligny is a fairly is a desperate place. The economy is depressed. Most of the whites who live there are poor whites. They're railway pensioners. They're people who don't have jobs at all and subsist on state charity.
And the same would apply to the black community.
Exactly the same. It's like, you know, desperation on both sides of the railway track that bisects the town. We're absolutely willing to believe there's a lot of racism goes on behind closed doors in white Coligny. To be like irrational to presume otherwise, but stories in the newspapers about blacks being forced into separate queues from whites at the OK Bazaar as well. You know, I went there and bought cigarettes, and that wasn't true. And then I asked, like, especially Indians about, is this true? And they said, never happened to me. And then, you know, the media trades in these cliches about apartheid, but then with a tiny little bit of effort, I found myself speaking to this ancient Muslim gentleman and his wife, who's like an Afrikaner, who used to be a nurse. They're both in their 70s. They just got married for love. If Coligny was the sort of apartheid gothic horror place that it's supposed to be, they would surely have had their windows broken or at least been sort of shunned or run out of town by AWB thugs and white racists. Instead, what happens to them on the 24th of May is their neighbor's house gets burnt down and they're set to terror-stricken flight by another force entirely.
What do you get the sense, because in your article, I wasn't sure, and it hasn't really come out. The true motivating factor behind the people who go and burn down those houses, for example, is it sort of youngsters who are poorly educated, are driven by a politician who's arrived in town a couple of days earlier and has said things that has riled them up, and they're just kind of reacting? Or is there
That's the sort of question that I can't answer. It's like I and every other journalist in that town, if you ask anyone, did you participate in the looting? Did you break this bottle store? And were you the guy who came with a bucky and took three bucky loads of beer, etc.? Nobody's going to admit that.
Yeah.
What journalists saw as their duty and what the system seems to encourage is that you go and you ask these polite questions. You ask anyone who's like with appropriate pigmentation. So are you the victim of racism? And then they say yes.
Yeah.
Is that a genuine perception? Yes, it is. But, I mean, what does that entitle you to do? Does it entitle you to...
I'm just wondering if... So in the chaos that Coligny becomes, and it kind of chaos begets the chaos. So it starts off with a bit of looting, and then a bit of looting is more looting, and then one house burning is another house burning. I suppose what I'm trying to understand is whether it's an isolated issue or whether there's actually an ideology driving it, which could spread. And I think that when many people saw what happened in Coligny, a lot of what they were thinking was, is this, you know, the race war we've been promised, is this real? Is this something that could happen? Are people, is this just a reaction in one small town, or is this something that we could see in every city in the country?
Well, listen, what I'm about to say, I'm indebted to a podcast by Isaac Duplessis in Afrikaans. Jeez.
You're popular.
I'm so sorry.
No problem.
This is not radio. We don't care.
Shit. It's 7:02, trying to get the exclusive bit late there. So you were saying about Isaac's podcast.
Sorry, yeah. So Isaac, he works for RS here. He did a wrap-up of Colony a few days ago. And he found, I mean, he's left-wing principal Afrikaner, but he found like a good source. A white woman used to live in the town and now lives in Iraq and had quite a lot of things to say about the sort of racist, alleged racist climate in the town. But she... God, I'm sorry, guys. I'm really mortified.
We're not, please. No need to apologize.
Sorry, back to the subject. Isaac, podcast. He finds this white woman who used to be embedded deep in the town and said, yeah, I know it's a racist place. It's like, you know, as soon as the door closes, you can hear whites saying racist things. But then she also, because she had friends and she had connections in the township, she didn't approve of what happened. She didn't approve of the violence and looting. And she offered the thing. She said that she had been part of a WhatsApp groups and so forth that indicated that what happened was essentially organized by the EFF.
Well, I wouldn't be surprised. They actually held a rally there today.
Ah.
Julius himself was there today. But I mean, what's his name? The Premier of the Northwest, Supra something.
Mashlo Mapela. Yeah.
That one. That person. Jeez. I can't say that one. Well, but I mean, he was there at the funeral of the boy that was tragically killed. And his whole eulogy was just pure scapegoating. The whites are responsible for this. They don't own the land themselves. I don't know if he had a call to action, so to speak. But on many counts, it was at the very least defamation, at the very worst hate speech, you know, throughout. And this was before the bail hearing where they got bail. So, I mean, to say that there is no political interference is naive in the extreme. And funny enough, if you read, I'm going to say this out loud, if you read the Huffington Post, they send two journalists to go out there, and it is a phenomenal piece of journalism. They ask questions to people on the streets, and the people on the streets said, we don't care too much. We are worried because we don't have any jobs here. Yeah. Because the road is a fucking dirt track. Because the police treat us differently to the white farmers. They were talking about the state inefficiency. They're not talking about interpersonal relationships. Yeah. So, I mean, which goes back to your point that it's a failure of the state, what happened. It's not really... There could be some interpersonal conflict between race groups. I'm not denying that. But... the attacks were against Indians, and the houses were against, I think, white farmers and an Indian family as well.
Yeah. And the doctor in the town.
Right. I mean, that doesn't sound like a race war between white and black. It sounds like maybe premeditated looting and arson.
Listen, if you were taking me, Isaac got the story that I was after. And so if we accept that this... what we've just discussed is true. You've got two factors working simultaneously. You've got a defensive ANC that is trying desperately to reinvent itself and especially the Zuma faction to hold on to power. And they've decided that the best way to do this is to become more radical and more extreme in order to counter a threat from Julius, whose movement, if we are to believe, Isaac was basically responsible for the agitation over the previous weekend that led to this demonstration, which led to like the outbreak of. I mean, what happened in Colony was in a sense it was like sort of the stuff from like a sort of a tragicomic, like sort of paranoid white nightmare from the 1960s, is where you get trapped on the roof of your burning house shouting, "It's not me, I'm a liberal." I mean, because there was so much violence and. Going on in that province and in that municipality at that time, there was sort of simultaneous service delivery protests at three different locations with cars and trucks being burnt and passing vehicles stolen and so forth, and all the police were there. So when this thing started in Colony, there were only five policemen on duty at the police station. Some people told me they didn't have a vehicle and there was just nothing that they could do. Like a very large crowd sort of came marching over the railway tracks, quite literally, and down the town's main road. And, you know, the police, there was simply no police in evidence. It's like, so it held its form for a while, didn't seem to have any leaders. And then looting started, and it was essentially 24 hours before law and order was reestablished. So it was very nervous and edgy.
All right. So
night for.
So it's kind of answers my question. There is an ideology that is driving it, which is seems to be quite nefarious in terms of achieving certain goals, political party wise. You write this piece. Before you write the piece or before you published, did you think it was going to cause any particular upset?
Probably not to the extent that it did. I knew that there were some sensitive things in it. There was and some language that wasn't going to appeal very strongly to certain people.
Hmm.
But I didn't.
I didn't think it was massively controversial.
I think, listen, this when you know when the heavens opened and carpet bombs started raining down on my ass there.
Hmm.
I mean, one of my reactions. This wasn't, you know, just obviously I hadn't told the black side of the story. You know, I didn't. You know, I was simply saying this. You know, this is what happened. This is why we need to pay attention to it. It's clearly a sign of things to come. I wasn't there to write alibis for the people who'd done the looting. I said, you know, just basically. We're looking at the series of events from the point of view of the racial minorities who are largely the victims of it. So I was obviously aware that in doing that, you're breaking the rules in South Africa. Did I anticipate this sort of...
support.
Well, support and blowback. I mean, there's lovely Australian lady, I think Sisonke Msimang, who wrote. She's in Australia, isn't she?
Yeah, she lives in Sydney.
Yeah,
she wrote this great piece. And the first paragraph had something about white anxiety. Then I couldn't read on because that doesn't exist. What the fuck is white anxiety? And then someone else, Nikki Fuckoff or Fuckoff, or I don't know what the fucking name is. Some academic from UCT, like that's a fucking haven of objective thought these days, also wrote a piece about the language you use, Rian. Because here's the thing, Mr. Malan, here's the thing. We care deeply about lived experiences, unless it's you. Unless you're an Afrikaner, then we don't give a fuck what you think about your lived experience.
That is a very neat formulation. I must congratulate you. That's great.
Oh, thank you.
You know, I was thinking as one of the things that was buzzing around my head as I was reading this new book by Paul McNally. The hero of it, it's a nonfiction book, and the hero is a coloured guy who's got an auto electrical shop on Decker's Road, and he strips his moor because like so guys are constantly dealing drugs outside his shop, and the police do absolutely nothing about it for a long time. So he eventually takes the law into his own hands, and he goes out there with a baseball bat, and on repeated occasions he donors these guys and put them in hospital. And that's vigilantism. You know, nobody pays any attention whatsoever. We have mob justice incidents daily in townships where criminal suspects are beaten to death by angry mobs. But the moment you get an Afrikaner even in the picture, this is incredible double standard. It's you know the incident becomes you know it becomes a global incident, and the sky is suddenly dark with like Jonas flying in from the outside world to pronounce that you know that apartheid is alive and well and that it lives on in rural South Africa where blacks are poor and whites are still rich. And that's that is such a tired cliche. That's so
because they want their pet project, Rian. There's a narrative with a capital N, which is whites, rich, evil, blacks, poor, destitute, not evil. And anything that goes against that narrative has to be squashed, including your lived experience, because you were actually there, unlike most of these other people who live across the world. You don't even come and place Kadigny on a fucking map, right?
Well, you know, I got to respond to Sisonke's remarks about me. I mean, she said that I was paranoid, and I had to concede that point. You know, I'm paranoid. It doesn't mean we're not going to Zimbabwe. But I guess the other point that I regret, let's put it this way, it's like I'd been to a birthday party the night before and had a crippling hangover that day and had the sense I read these two pieces in which I'd been sort of taken apart by these two very, very clever and very morally armored critics. And I just couldn't keep all the details straight. I said, just everything that you say is basically, you know, that they... If the price of agreeing with you is to like sort of lie and distort and suppress what I think is there, then I'm just simply not going to do it. And if the price I pay is to be called a racist and paranoid and so forth, then frankly, like Julius Malema, I don't care.
Right. The, no, indeed.
You know, Julius is, you know.
The, I mean, all I saw was middle-class urban moralism in a place that doesn't have a middle class or moralism at all. A place like Caligny, right? You got these urban pseudo-journalists who really think that they can use their state of mind to tell us what you really think.
But isn't the problem even deeper than that? I mean, I think that the underlying, our problem goes back to the Enlightenment. But anyway, the underlying, the idea that screws us up in South Africa is this idea that because all people are born equal and are equally gifted, all outcomes should be identical. And any exception to that, if there are too few women in the physics department and too few Africans in the geology department, and if whites own less than black in South Africa, that is taken as de facto proof,
right,
of racism or sexism or whatever, these evil things that we must all unite and move on. And all these conclusions are totally unsustainable. All these factors are influenced by enormous, like, cultural and economic complexities.
And humans are different, and difference is great. I mean, we bang this drum all the time, yeah, on this podcast, exactly what you've just said, because you don't find equality in any specific area does not mean that there's a problem. It's a false God equality in the sense that everything must be equal. It's a false god or false idol.
Okay, there are areas in which everything in things must be equal. If you show me black South Africans with the same qualifications as white people who are earning considerably less
absolutely
because they're black, that is wrong, okay?
Absolutely agree.
But if you look at the only part of the South African economy controlled by the dreaded white monopoly capital, which is the formal sector, according to Mark Schüssler, inequality in the formal sector, which is the gap between the obscenely compensated CEO and the shop floor grunts, slots in just above or below Switzerland. I mean, we're not that extreme. In fact, if you looked even closer at the formal sector, you're going to see lots of black people like being earning a premium, up to 40% in the case of guys with degrees in the hard sciences, in geology, in IT, etc. There are quotas to fulfill and they're really scarcer, therefore they earn more money. That's how capitalism and various other things work. It doesn't, none of these statistics says that, like, this oft-heard quota that white household incomes are 6 times or 5 times like higher than black black household incomes. Technically, that appears to be true, but it doesn't mean what it says. It doesn't mean to say that I am being paid 6 times more than a 62-year-old black journalist. I haven't had a job since 1977, so that's a bullshit example. but you know, I mean,
you're a very shitty capitalist, I have to say.
Dude, I've never made an investment in my life. I don't trust those guys. I used to be a real socialist. I bought a house. That's all I ever done. I'm not going to speculate in the stock market. I'm a Calvinist. I think there's nothing for Mahala. But let me just finish this point. I mean, you probably know the work of Mark Schüssler, the economist.
Yes.
Who points out that, you know, the average South African is like sort of 39, 40 years old, often has a university degree, has been working for decades and earning steady raises, usually both mom and dad working in the household. And so, yes, they have this towering household income, whereas the average black South African is 20 or 21, probably hasn't finished matric, doesn't have a job, and might never get one the way we are going. So, I mean, this is something that people, that's the chief cause, the primary cause of inequality in South Africa is inescapably that. It's like black, I perceive, like, what I feel like to be white is that I'm being held by the throat by one hand and being throttled because I'm a racist and because the system is unjust and unfair and unequal, and at the same time being whipped if we try to do anything about inequality in South Africa, which is the only thing that we can do, is to try and make the economy grow and try and create jobs for the people who are really suffering in this country, which is the 9 million people that don't have any jobs at all and don't have any social grants because they're in the wrong age group. And I mean, you guys know, you know the literature, you know the surveys. Whenever you have an opinion survey about South Africa, it's like, always says the same thing. It's like, overwhelming majority of people, their central and desperate obsession is job creation.
Yeah, it is. And usually it's, you know, the top things that South Africans care about is jobs, employment, housing, and health.
And education.
Those are, you know, race and those other things don't really...
It's, Jonathan, it's almost like that they are people. It's quite remarkable. It's almost like they don't know what postmodern racialism is. Don't you find that astounding? I mean, UCT keeps telling me about everyone thinks we're racist, but if you actually go speak to them, you know, the poor people, and you ask them the questions, they're like, I just want a better life. It's almost like they have agency. It's quite remarkable.
You guys are radical. That's good. But there's no such thing as moderation in the pursuit of truth and justice. So,
is it radical to say that black people have agency? Is it radical to say that a poor person does not want to be poor? How is that radical?
I'm afraid so, because it diverges from you're supposed to add very very quickly thereafter that they're poor because of the legacy of apartheid, colonialism, neo-colonialism, World Bank policy, imperialism, and structural problems in the. I mean, that's the only context that you're allowed to present
and,
these.
And
things.
I fully accept that apartheid had a massive factor to do with that. Anyone who doesn't agree is a bit deluded in my eyes. But I know what the answer is. But my answer is, you grow the economy, you take away minimum wage, you let people enter the marketplace.
Oh, please, man.
You deregulate so that you
it's really not hard.
But these, hallelujah.
But these fucking lefty. I get really frustrated, but these lefty fuckers who just want to redistribute and blame and shift guilt and do everything in their power to not let that happen, because then those people are off the fucking plantation and they can't control them.
Exactly.
That's what irritates me the fucking most.
Exactly. And it would be harder to manipulate them by appealing to their most primordial resentments.
And I don't resent that poor people feel that way, because they have nothing else. If I was like that and someone said, give me power and I'll give you what you want, fuck it, I'll be the first in line.
So don't you think we should establish a very large bursary fund and send hundreds of thousands of South Africans to China, starting with Nikki Falkoff, maybe, and these other people to China and Singapore,
Nikki Falkoff lives in Cape Town, probably one of these whites on the Atlantic seaboard who likes to opine on all the suffering of people less fortunate than her, but has never crossed over so far as to leave the city bowl.
And all these fucking people live in the whitest area in the fucking country.
But I do agree with you. Perhaps that would be an interesting solution. I mean, I'd be interested in something like that, something that bypasses government and increases education, and educates, gives people a great education. I don't know if China's the answer.
Just go to Botswana. That's right. Yeah, you can just drive.
It's true.
Triple A rating, and they're not afraid of saying it on Twitter. If you haven't noticed, it's almost like they're making fun of us.
But education these days can come in many forms, and I think that if you want to educate people on how society can move forward and should move forward, universities have proven again and again that they are not the places to do that.
On the contrary.
Universities are the places to teach STEM subjects, pretty much, and for the rest of it, they are sheltered employment for people who otherwise are useless in the real world. That's essentially become my view on it. I cannot see. I think there was probably benefit in the sociology departments, maybe 20, 30 years ago. And even then, they were pushing it a bit. Now it's so overrun. It's Marxism together with postmodernism that there is nothing left, which is valuable. And frankly, if every single sociology department were to go up in flames and there were nothing left tomorrow morning, I do not think we would be any worse off.
Well, I think we'll be a lot better. What are you talking about? That's an improvement.
Well, what about if we just close down all the humanities and sociology, political science departments, and use the resources we've thus gained to like sort of educate huge numbers of confident and strong black engineers and scientists and nuclear physicists.
But we don't need to educate in that way. People will find their way. Just give them freedom, Rian. For the first time in someone's life, give them some freedom.
Yeah.
And choice and agency.
Ramon wants to give everyone free Wi-Fi. It's not a bad argument.
It's not at all there.
I think it should be a human right in that respect.
Or put it this way, free YouTube. Free YouTube, and you can pretty much find most.
And there's only 5 channels available. Ben Shapiro, the Young Republicans, and I don't know.
And a whole bunch of science, stuff, not Bill Nye.
No, we said science, not entertainment. Science, which is not Bill Nye.
But why do you guys think you do this more often than I do? How come the ANC can't strike it? Why is it so difficult for South Africa to produce a black leader who is going to push these pro-growth policies? Who's going to just slap down these like irritating sort of spoiled white people who?
Because propaganda is pernicious. That apartheid was capitalist. Speak to any ordinary person, they think apartheid was capitalist. Where it was actually national socialism. When you have a banana board who decides the shape of your fucking bananas and who you're allowed to sell it to, that cannot be capitalist in its lightest.
You know, you're completely right. It's like a capitalist believes in free markets, inter alia for labor. If you go back to Cecil John Rhodes, who invented the mine compound system, I mean, this was expressly designed to crush every manifestation of a free market in labor. Yes. So, you know, laborers were recruited like somewhere near the equator, marched to the nearest railhead, trucked to Kimberley and cattle cars, and then ushered down a barbed wire corridor into a compound, which is effectively a prison. And it was illegal for them to desert, and it was illegal for anyone to attempt to, for any white man who went there and tried to offer them more money, was also illegal.
Yeah.
The last thing they wanted, that's not a capitalist thing, it's feudalism, or it's like, I don't know.
Well, slavery, in some sense. Okay. Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. I mean, people think slavery ended because it was immoral. No, because it's a shitty economic system. It's deeply shitty. It's far better to pay people to do a job, and they'll actually do better. Like, funny enough, if you don't own them as property, they actually do a better job because they're getting remunerated for it. That's the only reason slavery died.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I've got big faith in only... No, well, not faith. I'm an anarchist at heart, so I don't... like any of these people, but
there's no faith in an anarchist's heart.
No. So there's only 2 people, Sully Msimanga, Mayor of Pretoria, and Herman Mashaba. If they remain in the DA, then we've got a bit of hope. But if the DA wins and it's just ANC light, what's the point? Like, what is the fucking point? And that's becoming like that, unfortunately. Uh-huh.
I think there's a disconnect. There's a false belief between what real people think and feel. We saw this in the American election. If you only watched the media prior to that election, Hillary was going to win. I mean, let's reference the Huffington Post for the second time. 98% chance of winning. What was that? 20 hours before the election. You know the. There's a belief of what people want to hear, and so that gets peddled, and it's quite manipulated by the agendas and the leanings of various organizations. And then there is what people truly think. We saw it in our own elections here last time, the local government elections. We were told that at best, you know, for example, the DA would win PE if they were lucky. And there was no hope. There's that vape pen again that Rob loves so much. At best, you know, they would get PE, and there was no hope of Joburg and Pretoria. And yes, I know it came as about a coalition, but there's obviously a large disconnect there, because what we get told and what actually happens is very different. I don't think most people do buy into this rhetoric, which is why I asked that question before of whether you think there's a real danger, because the reality is it doesn't take... It won't take 50 million people to set fire to the entire country. It'll take 5,000. Unfortunately. And so, you know, I echo Ramon's sentiments that people who clearly have a very free market view, even though they don't necessarily always behave in that way. Herman Mashaba has been a little bit of a disappointment recently in that respect. He's been less libertarian, less conservative in some of his decisions he's made within the city. Personally, I think that's a pragmatic approach he's had to take, because in government and in politics, victories come quite slowly.
Yes.
And you see, when you speak honestly and openly, as Helen Ziller now does, because she's got nothing left to lose.
No fucks to give.
Yeah. She doesn't care. She's gone after this next election. Her time as premier is done, and she will, who knows, maybe she'll start a decent media group. But she speaks openly, but that's not good for politics. Herman, people like Herman Mashaba, I mean, Solly Msimanga, as far as I'm concerned, should be running the DA. He's superb. He just doesn't seem to have taken any time for shit. But he also doesn't sell lines. One of Musi's issues, in my opinion, is that he sells lines. He's also good at coming up with things like, we have a good story to tell. So as Ramon says, ANC light could be a real concern.
I just keep on thinking, isn't it possibly the case that a centrist, essentially, or instinctively centrist leader like Cyril Ramaphosa or Musi, I can mention a few others, that they allow themselves to be intimidated by this tiny cast of well-educated white academics and their acolytes, who now have important positions and voices in the media, and Twitter, and that this creates, and they think that that's the public. I keep thinking, dude, maybe it isn't. Maybe, what if you just shrug this off like a giant and stand up and say, I will no longer listen to this nonsense.
It's not the public, but it takes great strength to shrug that off. At every level, when we started this podcast, we were told we would at best get 200 listeners. And we are now pretty much the one of the largest podcasts in the country, if not the largest. It takes a lot of belief to shrug that off. And I think if you're someone like Musi Maimane or Cyril Ramaphosa, and all you see is that stuff being thrown at you, because the entire media swings left, so all you see is that agenda, and Twitter obviously, and the social media space is dominated in that respect. It's very difficult to believe that everything, that even though all the inputs you're being given lean one way, that the reality leans the opposite.
Yeah, but I mean, don't underestimate their ability to patronize their voters as well. It's much easier to say, vote for me and you'll get what you want, rather than vote for me and I'll set you free.
To get what you want yourself.
Yeah, for yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's much easier to say, I'll give you what you want. It's much easier. And unfortunately it works, because people are desperately poor.
And hopeless, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, what can I say at the end of that, other than...
On that depressing note...
Well, no. I mean, let's go back. I mean, are you right for time, Rian? Do you have anywhere to go? Okay. Let's go back. You stated that you were paranoid. I understand that paranoia, and I share some of it. I'm not going to lie. The thing about South Africa, and Helen Ziller actually told me this, when you're not supposed to drop names, but on Twitter she told me, at least. So South Africa's always been at 5 minutes to midnight for at least a century. Any minute there could be something catastrophic and it's all fucked up. And it never seems to happen. I have zero faith in many things, but I do have a bit of faith in the population of this country to not fuck it up in a way that's not, that we can't get back from, is there any glint of hope for you in that way?
If I had to believe the opinion surveys, then they condemn me. They say that I'm a cynic and a pessimist and certainly a prophet with absolutely no honor in this country. All I can say is, dude, I hope and pray. I would be so happy if I'm proven to be a complete arsehole, and if I wind up with egg on my face and it turns out, come on, South Africa, fucking surprise me. Make me look like a moron. Show that I'm talking shit. I'll dwindle off into retirement and you won't hear anything else from me because of my deep shame. You get that?
Yeah. Yeah. So I don't know if you answered it though. Is there hope? Or maybe hope is the wrong word, but do you foresee some scenarios that may work out which are actually beneficial?
Give us in your lifetime. So, I mean, it's hard to say in 50 years or 100, but, you know, you said you're 62.
But say in the next decade.
My faith in the free market idea, the idea I talked about of China as this towering gorilla in the room, I keep on hoping and praying that there must be some sort of slow and steady accretion of people recognizing that the path down which all our leaders wanted to lead us now is like the wrong one. It's not going to help, especially like the poorest people. But now I'm sounding like a liberal again, and I don't want to do that. Is there hope? In all my life in South Africa, there's been this extraordinary contradiction between the politics and who we're supposed to be and how things are like in my personal life. It's like the people, the black people that I interact with and that I see every day. I love them, and at risk of fucking extreme contradiction, I think they at least sort of like me.
Right.
Our relationships might not be equal, but there's a great deal of reciprocity in them. I do the best by them that I can, or whatever. It's like they buy me cigarettes without being asked, and I return the favor, and then I buy drinks, and they buy drinks, and then we sit there drinking and clinking our glasses and finishing our lines about what a desperately bad situation South Africa is in. But it is a manifestation of the secret history of love in Azania, because there is quite a lot of that still.
Yeah. I think there's a glint of hope in that analogy.
Well, that's a bit more positive. I think we can end it there.
Really? Do you want to end on hope, though? I'm not fucking Barack Obama.
You can end on something else if you want, but I'm fine there.
Right. Okay, well, just one last thing from me. Yeah, oh, Rian, please, go ahead.
I mean, you guys started with Donald Trump. So I was just wondering, I've been watching this drama. The people who are attacking Trump, the people who are leaking the stuff about him, they know exactly what Flynn said to the Russian ambassador. Okay? They've been looking and they unmasked him and they've been sharing that stuff and chortling about it a long time ago, for months already.
Mm.
So, I mean, it could have been something really like dastardly, like Ivan. It's like our plot has come to fruition and thanks to your hacking. It's like, and now Hillary's dead and we can proceed with our secret plan for world domination. Or it could also be like, how's it, man? How are you doing? Yeah, no, thanks. I'll tell the president, you say congratulations, sweet, and we'll see you.
Yeah, it's probably something in between. Like, listen, these sanctions are a bit rough. And if you could look at trying to get the sanctions dropped or lifted or whatever it is, that would be great. It's probably something like that.
But why is America and the world being kept in the dark about what actually was said in that conversation? Because that's the root of the whole thing. Like, just, you know, come on.
It's not I suppose because either it's not bad enough to, if it was bad enough to completely sink him, it'd be like Watergate, right? They'd release the worst of it. It would be enough to destroy him overnight. I think in regards to the Trump presidency, he was never going to be allowed to just have 4 years. He was never going to be given a chance. And personally, I think this will blow over. It's now got a special investigator that they can't really moan about.
Special counsel.
Special counsel.
Let's not forget, Rian, since January the 20th, the mainstream media, as people call them, are really, really, really worried about due process. All of a sudden, they're really worried. I mean, there was amnesia for 8 years. Obama did whatever he could. You don't impeach a president if he drops 30,000 bombs a year. You don't kill a president who destroys Yemeni wedding parties. You don't impeach a president who spies on everyone, including foreign leaders. You don't impeach a president that funds drug cartels in Mexico. You don't impeach any of these acts. There may have been conversations with Russia. Boom, impeachment. Get fucked. Really now. Like, really. It will blow over. Just probably a recipe for vodka.
It'll
or something worse, but who gives a shit?
It'll blow over whatever it is, and then there'll be something else. I guarantee it. And there will be something else for 4 years until they either get it right and manage to impeach him, which they might do after 2018 because they'll control the House after 2018 if he carries on like this. And then the Democrats will impeach him for eating a peach. It will be that stupid. No.
My favorite line of the Trump era has been this guy Charles Murray, who's a conservative in his own right, but he turned against Trump. He didn't wasn't supporting.
Yeah, he was a never Trumper, I think.
And so then he starts getting attacks and messages from sort of people who are supporting Trump, and they said, "No, listen, there's something going here that you don't understand. We don't support Trump because we like him or we approve of him. We support him because he's a murder weapon." Yeah. I.e., yeah, a murder weapon against this sort of like sneering, condescending metrosexual elite in the cities who, you know, aren't that interested in ordinary redneck Americans.
Yeah, the flyover states.
It's the coastal elites versus everyone else. And all the journalists live on the coasts, on the eastern or western coast. They're all from Boston, New York, California, Los Angeles, shit like that. They're the ones making the news. They're the ones who are controlling the way information is leaked. They're spreading misinformation a lot of the time and then correcting it 2 days later. But the misinformation gets 5,000 retweets. The correction gets 200 retweets. It's a clash of cultures at the end of the day.
And in all of this, he is doing things wrong, which are completely going unnoticed.
Fucking, and he's a fucking baby. he must grow up as well.
What did he do recently? Oh, I mean, he has Erdogan. He invites Erdogan over to D.C. to meet with the guy. I mean, he should never have done that. That's despicable. And he should be getting nailed in the press and by everyone for having done that. On top of it, Erdogan then there's a protest outside the Turkish embassy. And he seemingly instructs one of his bodyguards to go and cause violence among the crowd, during which American citizens are assaulted by Turkish bodyguards. That's unacceptable. It doesn't matter who the president is. This should be the headline news. But unfortunately, they're so obsessed with the Russia stuff, which it really is neither here nor there at this point. And really bad stuff that he's doing is getting ignored. I mean, he's on his way to Saudi Arabia, I think, as we speak, doing his big world tour, Saudi Arabia, the Vatican, Israel, and Belgium. I don't know how Belgium got thrown in there, but
it's not in the country.
Yeah, you Frenchman, eh? You won't let it go.
That's not a fucking country. It was created to stop Hitler from invading. What did he do? He just fucking invaded anyway.
But he's going to go to Saudi Arabia, sign, you know, a large arms deal with Saudi Arabia, $100 billion, I think, in an arms deal, after having nailed Hillary on the fact that her campaign and her foundation was funded in large part by the Saudis. So he deserves criticism for all of this, and he's wrong on all of it, but it's being missed. It's being missed amongst the hysteria.
They're hitting him for stupid stuff, and they're missing out on the big stuff. All he has to do is two things: build the fucking wall and drain the swamp. So far, none of that's happening. He's losing sight. Because he's never had a boss. He's never worked for anyone in his life. So he doesn't understand authority at all. So, I mean, anyway, that's my view on Trump.
That's where we stand on Trump.
I mean, yeah, that's our view on Trump.
You done?
I'm done.
Yeah. Anything else to add?
I was just speechless. It's cool. Thank you very much for having me. It's very good.
Well, geez.
I mean, Rian, it's our pleasure to host you on this little podcast, you know, and it gets a dozen downloads or so every hour. But it's been an immense pleasure to have you. Thank you so much. And I'm going to sound like a capricious youngster, but just keep writing, man. Your work is absolutely immense. And fuck everyone else who says otherwise.
Yeah.
Keep writing.
Thanks, bro.
Yeah,
that's my fist on my chest.
Part of the bro force.
Hashtag bro force.
Hashtag bro force.
And if you want to find us on other social media, where can we find you?
I've got my Twitter handle is deadwhiteman2, but I've never tweeted. I just like sort of set it up and.
All right. Well, you can tweet all your hate at deadwhiteman2.
Yes. Yes.
So
I praise.
Well, sure, but you know, the hate's more fun. Obviously, you can find us at renegade_report.
And join our Facebook group, please. It's quite immense. Just the search for Renegade Report Group on Facebook and come join us. There's immense conversations every day there.
Awesome. And as always, at Roman Kabanak, at Jonathan_Witt, thank you for listening. We'll catch you next time. Cheers. CliffCentral.com.